Hi, my name's Patrick, and I'm an alcoholic. That's a true story. I picked up the little program here, and I thought, oh, Sissy's a 10-minute speaker. And they must have two. And it really kind of surprised me. And, well, there you go. You know, it's kind of funny. I was, my name's Patrick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Patrick.
You know, early in the week, when I thought I really was a 10-minute speaker, I kind of thought, you know, my ego got the better of me, and I thought, ha, 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 what if that main speaker is sick and I get to be the main speaker? Boy, am I stupid. Anyways, I think I'm going to start with a little disclaimer because my story involves drugs. And I don't mean to offend anybody, but it's just a part of my story. And I've kind of reconciled it this way for myself, and that, you know, my drug use, I believe, was just one more symptom of the same disease, alcoholism. And some people exhibit that symptom and others don't, but it's part of my problem. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, and I don't really know what day I became an alcoholic or what drink, or I just don't know. I've kind of moved myself away from that discussion. I don't care anymore. I mean, I just am, and that part isn't going to change. So it doesn't really matter whether I was born with it, inherited it, found it on the ground. I got it, and you know, got to have something in this world, and this is what I got. I know early on I had what would probably be considered, you know, some abnormal behaviors. I was just an emotional little child. And, you know, when I was about 4 or 5, I was pretty young, I don't remember what it was about. That'll tell you how important it was. I don't know what it was about, but I got very angry at my parents about something. Very angry. And I was going to run up to my room at a two-story house. And I got to the bottom of the stairs, and before running up to my room, I thought I'd put an exclamation point on how mad I was at them. And I kicked the wall really hard. And my mom used to dress me in these little clodhopper boots. And my foot went right through the wall. And my dad went through the roof. He didn't think it was funny at all. I'd have killed myself, or I'd have killed the child that did that. I don't have children, so I can say that. That was just me. I was just ruled by my emotions. I was so mad over who knows what it was now, but I remember how mad I was. I remember kicking that hole in the wall. And he left it there for a long time. God, he left it there just so I could think about it, you know, afterwards, after we discussed it. And what he told me what he thought of my behavior, and, you know, and I felt bad. I felt bad, and every time I walked past that little hole in the wall, I thought, oh, look what I did, you know. I was out of control. And I remember one weekend, he was home, he was doing the stuff around the house, and he got out the spackle and the, you know, all the tools, the implements of destruction for fixing holes in the wall, and I helped. I was just so proud of myself for helping. We patched that wall up, sanded it, he painted it, it looked great, you know. Took a couple weekends to do that. You know, I got mad at him one day after that, and I was really mad again. Again, I couldn't tell you what it was about, but my emotions got the better of me, and I was going to storm off to my room, and I was going to give the wall a little boot there, and this time I thought my foot won't go through, and I thought it would be different, and man, I put a hole right through the wall. I handled it a lot better than he did, and he was furious, and you know, I don't know if that's the definition of insanity, thinking that it was somehow going to be different, but it wasn't. I felt bad again, and there was this hole. And We lived with that hole in the wall for a long time. I think he knew I felt bad about it. And, you know, I should be lucky to be alive, man. I would, you know, I just... that's justifiable homicide, as far as I'm concerned. He could have gotten away with it, but... enough about my childhood. My goal was 10 minutes too, sissy. anyways... I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember a lot. That happened to me. But I know I used to sneak drinks and sip drinks and stuff like that. And I don't remember that first one where it just felt great. I just wanted to try it. So I got into my junior high years. I think the first time I recall going out and drinking with people, we got a stole a bottle of wine from somebody's parents, and we didn't know about pushing the cork in, so we busted the top off on a fire hydrant, you know, kind of strained it through our teeth. And I don't have a drinking problem though. And I liked it. You know, I remember I was like seventh, eighth grade, and I was with these members of the basketball team. I was real short, so I wasn't on it, but I was hanging out with them, and I felt really good about it. You know, you know how you just kind of slide into a group after a while? I just thought it was great. And I didn't think, well, look, I'm a self-centered person and I have all these emotional problems and, you know, I might be an alcoholic. It was the last thing on my mind for a long, long time. That just didn't occur to me. I don't know if I'd crossed the line or what. And again, it doesn't really matter. But I got drunk a couple more times in junior high and high school. I discovered drugs and... I started smoking pot, you know, tried it a couple times, I liked it. I liked pot right away. I liked alcohol right away. By my junior year in high school, I was a daily pot smoker. Drank every weekend. I just lived for it. You know, I smoked pot all week long, thinking about the alcohol I was going to drink on the weekend. You know, I didn't sit there and analyze it. I never did. I just thought, you know, I thought I was a pretty happening, partying guy. You know, I'm fitting in. I feel good. I fit in with all the dopers who hung out in this one parking lot. But, I mean, I felt like I belonged somewhere, and that was evidently very important to me. And, well... I was going to say to make a long story short, but I better not. Wow. You know, I might lapse into these moments of total silence, because when you do a lot of drugs, you damage a lot of brain cells, and occasionally the brain cells that are carrying out the function of my speaking kind of give out, or they, I don't know what they do, they take a rest, and I forget what I was talking about, so... I'll let you know. You'll probably know, but it happened before I do. So, by becoming a daily pot smoker, I earned a grade point average that was probably what you'd expect from a daily pot smoker. Not very good. And it was time to graduate from high school, and most of my friends were going to college. I thought, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to go to college. So... I was never big into taking action. I had lots of plans, you know. I had all sorts of plans how life was going to turn out. God, it required me to write letters and fill out applications and things like that in order to go to college. And I think I got turned down by everybody I applied to. Oh, what a crushing thing for an alcoholic. I felt so bad. Nobody wants me. And I didn't want to go. Somehow I thought for some reason that I shouldn't go to a community college and maybe attempt to build up a grade point average so somebody will take me. I thought that I don't have to do that. And And I get very upset, you know. I smoked a lot of pot and thought about it, and, you know, why weren't they letting me in? And I remember thinking that, you know, how unfair the world was, that people I didn't even know were making decisions about my life, you know. Somebody looked at my name on a piece of paper and said, oh no, look at those numbers. Those numbers can't be right. And they didn't take me. And I got really resentful about it, and I thought about what I was going to do for a while, and just to kind of show the world how I was right and they were wrong, and how I was going to change things, I decided that, you know, I wasn't going to put up with people making decisions about my life for me. So I joined the Navy, where they make virtually every decision you ever have to make immediately. As soon as you're in, you don't have to think anymore. They just tell you what to do. And believe it or not, I did very well for a while with that. I needed direction. By God, I needed direction. And they did. They told me when to get up. They told me when to eat. They told me when to go to class. They told me when to work out. They told me when to, you know, run. Running. And it was exactly what I needed. And I did, you know, you hear lots of people who say they went into the military and how they had this horrible experience in boot camp, and I liked it. I thought, hey, I'm good at this, you know. I need direction. I'm good at taking direction. For a while, I'm a great starter. I'm just always been a real poor finisher. And just watch. there weren't one of those brain cells. I did very well in boot camp. I was meritoriously advanced. They promoted me. I was there 2 months. I got a promotion. I was like, oh, I'm good. I'm good at this. And I thought, you know, I could just maybe stay right here and be in the Navy for a long time. And they sent me to a school to train me for the job that they wanted me to do. And I had for a kid 18 years old out of college, out of high school, I ended up with a great, great job. My job, after attending... All right. Let me tell you about training a little bit, since I have the time. I was going to school. I was working real hard because they'd tell me what to study, and it felt like, I don't know, they were paying me. Maybe they should have paid me in high school, but I felt like I needed to study, and I was doing pretty well with it. But you could drink there. Oh, you could drink a lot. They really frowned on smoking dope and stuff like that, but. You could drink just as much as you could stand, as long as you stayed on the base. You know, you could go to the enlisted club and you could get like 60-cent mixed drinks. And I drank as many as I could. You know, I brought a whole pile of change with me and lots of 60-cents, and I bought drinks. And God, I love that. I just loved it. I thought, you know, this is where I belong. I felt like I belonged, and I was happy with the way things were going. And I went through a couple of schools, one of them down in Jacksonville, Florida. And by this point, I'd reached a point where I think the drinking age there was low enough that I could go off the base and drink in the bars, which I thought was pretty great, too. And, you know, when people talk about their alcoholism, they talk about this progression from, you know, well, this was my position, and I ended up in the gutter here over time. Well, for me, that was a nightly progression. I looked good when I went out to start, but when I woke up in the morning, I was in the gutter. I mean, that progression took one night for me every night. Just kept running back up, get on the slide, and go back down it. And I woke up one morning, I felt terrible, and I used to go to this bar. Like you care, but it was the Holiday Inn bar in Jacksonville, Florida, about 5 miles down the road. And I'd get rides because I didn't have a car, and somebody would drive me there, and I'd drink, and soon enough, the people I went with would be like, well, you know, nothing's happening here or whatever, let's go home. God, that just, you know, I was well into my alcoholic drinking. I don't know where the line was, but I was there, you know. And that was not leaving. I just was not going to go with them. I was like, I'll find my way home. You know, it's It's a nice 5-mile walk after you're loaded down a freeway. It's no problem. And this one morning, I woke up and I became a member of the Sunburned Tongue Club. I'd fallen asleep on the side of the road. And, you know, I used to gauge how well I was walking at night, you know, by, well, I knew it was dangerous. They actually had, you know, it's not real uncommon at military bases that somebody falls asleep in the road and gets run over. Occasionally that would happen. And I knew it was dangerous, so I would just try and, you know, stay on that the shoulder, you know. And you were doing bad if you were staggering out to the fast lane. You know, you just start moving sideways and you couldn't stop it. You know, I know that there had to be a power greater than myself looking out for my well-being. Anyways, I woke up this one morning on the side of that road, and I was sunburned. I don't tan even when I want to, and I didn't really want to that morning, and it was actually probably about noon by then, and you know, noon in the Florida sun, boy, you get a great burn down there. And my feet were half in this drainage ditch and half out. You know, I later learned that those drainage ditches in Florida have alligators in them, you know. And that became a joke for me a while. I'm going to go feed myself to the alligators tonight. You know, that would be the big thing for me, is that I was always so proud of myself for making it home. On the nights I made it home, I thought, wow, I did good. I never, for the life of me, thought that there was a problem. I just thought that I was one of the most happening, partying people I had ever come across in my life. And, you know, I was obviously looking through at the world through a different pair of glasses, because from, you know, I must have just looked like a speed bump on the side of that road, you know. But I tell you this, I got about 1 million of those, basically. Every night was some grand adventure of me getting into trouble. Occasionally I was pulled in by people in uniforms, mostly for my own protection. I passed out one evening. They wouldn't let me walk through. I actually walked that 5 miles, and they wouldn't let me walk through the gate with an open container. I just thought that was ridiculous. And anybody in their right mind would have thrown it away, and I said, well, I'll just go over here and drink it, and then I'll go through. But, you know, once I sit down and I'm in that shape, I don't do very well. I sat down. I ended up just kind of passing out there. Well, it's kind of a nice grassy area. They keep it well mowed, and they have a big airplane up on a pedestal. It's like the front lawn to the gate to the base. They evidently had a big problem with that. It's bad PR to have drunk sailors laying on the front lawn of the base. And so some guys came out, and I remember the questions. I just had a hard time formulating answers. And they said, are you all right? And I thought about it, and I said, yeah, I was okay. You know, I was happy to be away from the freeway. It was nice there. I was comfortable. They asked, well, do you need any help? And I thought, no, not at all. Anyways, they dragged me inside, I don't know. They had badges. I guess they're not shore patrol. They're like Navy police. I'm not sure what the deal was there. I never figured all that stuff out. They brought me before some officer, and he questioned me about it. And I says, look, you know, I just drank a little bit too much. Had a problem. You know, sorry. And they gave me a ride back, which I thought was, that part was good. I didn't have to walk the rest of the way. But again, I just had these nightly, incredibly adventurous episode sometime. That nightly progression into the gutter for me. It also didn't occur to me, or I didn't take note of, I suppose, that nobody I was hanging out with was having similar experiences. I didn't question it. I just thought, I have a much better time than they do, because they leave you know, when they can still drive. And you know, I don't know if they were drinking and driving or what. I wasn't counting their drinks. I don't care. And but you know, I don't know. I guess they'd just go home and sit, you know, whereas I would, you know, sit in the bar and drink. And I smoked pot sometimes, but I was always so paranoid about it. They make you pee in the bottle, you know, and check and see if the service people are doing drugs. And so I was always concerned when I'd smoke pot. You know, it's terrible, though, to smoke dope and be paranoid for another 30 days, waiting for it to clear your system. I mean, it creates paranoia by itself anyways, but to sit there and dwell on it, you know, seems so alcoholic now. Moving right along. I ended up with a great job, though. I really did. I talked about that a little bit ago. And my job was to sit on this big airplane, four engines, sit in front of this radar scope about this big with keyboard and switches and scopes. And I just thought, this is great. And we were out hunting, at the time, Soviet submarines. And I just thought, what a great job for an 18-year-old alcoholic. I didn't think the alcoholic part, but I just thought this was a great job. I really liked it. I liked getting on the plane. I like, you know, walked around in my uniform, and I felt really, really good about it. You know, I just thought, I fit here. I fit in, and I'm happy. And I made it through the training squadron, and they shipped me off to a operational squadron and said, here you go. You're in the Navy now. And it was a job, and it was an adventure, and it was a lot of both for a while. And they had a rule about this, though. My job on the airplane was to read the radar, make sure you don't bump into mountains and clouds and bad weather and stuff like that. And the rule was about drinking. You weren't supposed to drink 12 hours before you went flying. You also weren't supposed to smoke within 50 feet of the airplane. And I was pretty good with most of their rules, but that one was impossible from the outset. I'd broken it in training. I just, you know, I didn't get caught. I didn't mention it to anybody. I was drinking less than 12 hours ago. Here I was. I was the new radar operator in this squadron. And it's like 400 guys, and usually as new people join, you kind of know about it. And I caught up to my squadron, and they were up in Iceland, where you drink. That's what you do. And which is, well, that's what I did. I know there were other people doing other things on that base. They had all sorts of hobby shops and bowling alleys and things like that. And they had bars. And so I went to the bars, and I felt really good about it. I got really loaded one night, and I made it home, which was good, because you kind of, you know, it's hard to imagine what Iceland is like, but it's, you know, got a lot of lava rock and snow. And, you know, it's not like walking on pavement. It's really hard to walk on snowy lava rocks, and I a lot of times get caught up, and, you know, and it looks so good in the morning. I showed up for my very first operational flight in that squadron one morning. It was like my first morning where I actually had to go to work and do my job. And I showed up drunk. And, you know, I don't have to tell you, you've been in similar situations, but it went over like a lead balloon. I stumbled in late into this briefing room, and it looked like something right out of James Bond with walls that light up, and it would show you the location of every Russian ship and plane and submarine in the world. And it was just, wow, gee whiz, look at that. And I stumbled into this room, and there were some very high-ranking people in there, and they were like, who's that? I smelled of booze. I hadn't showered. And they were like, God, that's our new radar operator. And I think they thought, well, he's new, he's young, this is an indiscretion on his part, and we're going to teach him a lesson. So they took me flying. And these were like 10-hour missions. And And they're not like the kind of flight you go on when you take a commercial airliner. They turn a lot, and they go up, and they go down, and it's very bumpy, and I didn't feel very well. I spent most of that, I'd take the oxygen mask. I thought I had an oxygen deficiency most of the time. I'd just take my oxygen and stuff it on my face and think, oh, this is going to make me feel better. So they took me with, and afterwards I had to stay late and clean the plane by myself. Usually it was a crew thing. There were like 13, 14 people on board, and they would all pitch in on the way back and clean up, but they just left me to do it myself. And I thought, oh man, I felt so misunderstood. They really overlooked it, because there's some specific rules that I think I'd broken a number of actual military laws, and they overlooked it and they didn't do anything. It was a slap on the wrist, and I got away lucky. When I did it again a week later, I got the. That's how I met my commanding officer. My first time I met him, I was in trouble. The punishment they mete out, they awarded me some penalties, and one of those was that 30 days of restricted duty, which I thought, no, how restricted could it be? Well, they moved me to this building they called the Restricted Barracks, and it had bars on the windows. I mean, that's jail. And I thought, man, this is jail. I didn't write home the whole time. I didn't say, write home and say, I'm in jail, you know. I come from a normal, if that's possible, Irish Catholic family. I got stability. We ate dinner at the same time. We held hands. We said grace. I have 4 sisters and 1 brother, and they're all very well adjusted and successful. And I know you're wondering how I shifted gears like this. Weren't we in the Navy? For me to end up behind bars was really a far cry from, I think, what my parents expected. They may have known that I had an alcohol problem, or maybe not. It was becoming more apparent. I liked to talk to them from Iceland when I was really hammered. And I never did figure out the time difference. I would wake them up at 4 in the morning, and they'd be like, what time is it there? I said, I don't know, it's the afternoon, and I was ripped. And it's morning, it doesn't matter, I don't know. But that is not what I think my parents expected. It's not really what I expected. And it was just for 30 days. Actually, I think they suspended the sentence. I didn't actually have to go. So you're wondering how I know there were bars. Well, I got drunk a couple days later and in trouble, and that's when they lifted the suspension and they moved me off there. And they sent me out to pick up trash in blizzard conditions in Iceland. And, you know, it's just so hard to feel patriotic about your country when they do that to you. It's so unfair. And I developed resentments and all sorts of things. And when I got out, I knew. I mean, they had told me. They said, look, you do this again and you're just gone. You're gone. We're not going to put up with any more of this. And so I didn't do it for weeks. I didn't do it. I didn't get caught for months. And when I got caught, I think it was the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, we're going to kick you out, and we're going to, take half your money before we kick you out, and, lose all your stripes. I should have put them on with Velcro after a while. You just put on the rank of the day. And I felt so bad. I thought, God. I mean, I didn't tell my parents about any of this. Now, how am I going to tell my family that, well, I'm coming home, a couple years early. I was scared. And somebody came to me and said, if you'll tell them you have a drinking problem, they'll send you to treatment and they won't throw you out. And I really believe that this was a message sent from higher up saying, look, we are going to give you a break, but you have to take the first step here. And I said, that's it. I have a drinking problem. Don't throw me out. And they sent me off to a treatment center. And I don't know if it's... I haven't been to a civilian treatment center, but I can tell you what military treatment center is like. I got in there and some guy says, look, you've been diagnosed with alcoholism. And alcoholism is a disease that affects the mind and the body. And it gives you a spiritual malady that we intend to treat here. And I thought, geez, you know, and he says, it affects you physically and you will run 3 miles a day. And I was like, God, I already hate treatment. And I was lying. I mean, there was a mountain of evidence. Oh God, I can't believe I said that. There was plenty of indicators that I was an alcoholic, but I was just there to stay out of trouble. While I was there, it was a good treatment center because they sent us to AA every day. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a great treatment center. And it wasn't costing me any money. And while I was there, the lights began to come on. I had to call my family and tell them, you know. I told them, actually, when they sent me there, I said, oh, I'm going to be out of the country. You know, it's highly secret stuff. We hunt Russian submarines. I can't tell you where I'm going. Then I called like 3 days later and said, well, I'm going to tell you where I'm going. I'm in D.C. I'm in Washington, D.C. in a treatment center for alcoholism. They weren't even surprised. They weren't even the least bit surprised. And it was so crushing to me to know that I hadn't fooled anybody. And while I was there and going to the meetings, and I began to hear and I'd listen and I identified and I said, I knew. I knew in my heart that I was an alcoholic. And I'd like to tell you that that was the last drink I took, but I was there because I'd hit the Navy's bottom. They couldn't take any more, but I was ready for a lot more. And I didn't even stay sober 90 days. I was in a world of hurt, too, if I got caught drinking. And I managed just barely to stay out of trouble. I was breaking the 12-hour rule. I was breathing alcohol on people and they were turning the other way because they just didn't... Nobody wanted to be involved in it anymore. And I, you know, those people are on my amends list. And some of them I haven't been able to track down, but I'll get to that. I got out. I made it all the way to the end of my enlistment and I got out. And they were asking me actually if I wanted to stay. They said, look, at this point in time, we need people who are trained to do your job. And we're going to offer you like a $30,000 cash bonus. Do you want to stay? I was like, no. I hated the Navy by then. It started out, I liked it so much and I hated it. I just hated it by then. I wanted out, and I told my commanding officer, and I told him why. And I said, I'm getting out because I can't stay sober. I'm going to get in trouble. And, you know, there are bigger concerns that, oh, he's a nuisance, is that I could cause the airplane to fly into something that, you know, didn't give. And, you know, I didn't want to be responsible for killing myself or my crew. It was probably a selfish motive. I didn't give a hoot about them. And I told him, and when I told him that, there was no more, oh, please stay. It was like, see ya. And that was a great responsibility for me, you know. I mean, I was young. I was, you know, involved in the navigation of a $30 million airplane. And I thought, you know, it kind of hurt to give up. It wasn't the money that, I never turned down $30,000 before, but, I mean, that wasn't the hard part. It was, you know, that I liked the job. And I got out and I told myself, well, when I go home, that's it. I'm done drinking. I've been telling myself on bar stools for the longest time. And, you know, I did. I sat in a lot of bars and, you know, I knew I was an alcoholic. I'd pull out this little card. You've all seen this little card. And I'd read it sometimes on the bar and go, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And I'd put it away. You know, they say a head full of AA and a belly full of alcohol, you know, doesn't go very well. But after a while, if you drink enough, you can forget all about AA. And, you know, I thought about it less and less. But I told myself, I was just such a willful son of a bitch, that I just said, you know, when I go home, I'm going to stop drinking. So I put off going home. All right? And my father is a genius. Told me to send what money I had home. And so I kept some. I'm not stupid. And I sent a lot home, and I didn't go home until I was kind of out of money and out of dope. I was smoking pot a lot again because, you know, wasn't in the Navy. Knew I was an alcoholic, and I got home. I got off the airplane, and it wasn't the first time I got off an airplane drunk when I came home. And I said, you know, I'm going to quit drinking tomorrow. Well, that's not very convincing coming from an alcoholic, and I don't think they were too convinced. But the next day, I had them. I told them that, and I drank right up to midnight. I was like, this is the last one. It's 10 seconds to midnight, you know, and I downed it, and I was like, that's it. I'm done. And believe it or not, that's the last drink of alcohol I ever had. That was it. I was an alcoholic. I knew it, and I had to go to AA, and I started going to AA on a regular basis. And, you know, we are not a weak-willed group of people. Alcoholics are some of the most strong-willed people I've ever met. Who else in the world would put up and go through that day in and day out of drinking and feeling like crap all for a few moments of, oh, I feel good about myself, and then it's gone? You know, it's a real paradox that the rest of the world, you know, there's that perception that alcoholics are, oh, they're so lazy and they have no self-control and they just have no willpower. Go find a guy on a street corner that's still out there suffering. That is the most strong-willed person you will ever meet in your life. I don't know how to do that. And today, if I drink, I am not afraid that I will die from it. I'm afraid I will live a long time. And I don't want to live like that. And I should tell you, did I mention I didn't quit smoking pot? No, I didn't. That part wasn't good. I was going to meetings and smoking a lot of dope and, you know, a couple other, I liked chemistry and, guess what? I still had that grade point average too from high school. I ended up having to go to a community college of all things to boost my grade point average to get into a 4-year university, which I did while I was smoking pot on a regular basis. And I thought school was really hard. I used to think, oh, this is so hard. And it was. And I was in AA for a year. I took a chip. I think I spoke for 10 minutes somewhere. I talked about how I was sober, how great I was. And I couldn't resolve the conflict because I was smoking pot and going to meetings, but I wasn't obviously doing the two at the same time, and I wasn't telling anybody. And, you know, and I thought to myself, I really thought I'd struck up a happy medium, you know. Look, you can do, if you do it right, you can smoke dope in moderation, which means every day, and go to meetings. And sometimes during the meetings, I would just be like, God, I hope this guy finishes talking so I can go get high. And I couldn't resolve the problem, and I knew it wasn't right, because why, if it wasn't right, wasn't I telling the rest of the world about my great secret about how you can have both? And if you're out there and you're doing both, you know, keep coming back, and I hope you feel bad, you know. First, 1986, and that was the last mind-altering chemical that I've taken. I haven't had a drink, I haven't had a drug. I hurt my shoulder and they injected me with something, but it seemed like a great idea at the time. Hurt real bad. Outside of that, though, I don't medicate myself. And, you know, I knew I got chins hit the floor at my home group. I was doing a pretty good job of hiding it from some people and a lousy job of hiding it from other people, because as I was getting honest, you know, there's people like nodding and like, finally, you know. It must have just been horrible to listen to me in a meeting, you know. for that year when I thought, you know, I knew everything. God, I knew so much. I wish I had all that knowledge back, because I don't know anything anymore. I just get dumber and dumber every year that goes by. You know, I knew why I was an alcoholic. I knew how I was an alcoholic. I knew how sobriety worked. I knew everything. And today, I don't know. I don't know why AA works. If you came here to hear that from me, I'm going to disappoint you here, because I don't know why it works. And just like I don't know why I'm an alcoholic and I don't care anymore. I just don't care. Because I am, that part's not going to change. So it's up to me to treat my disease. You know, as the disease lottery goes out there these days, this is not the worst thing you can end up with. And, at that point, I was in school and I was full of self-pity and self-loathing, and I just, I couldn't see how my life was going to get better. And I got, there I was, and I was an AA, and I was a one-day newcomer, and I hated it. It occurred to me that without smoking pot, that sitting in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated them. I didn't like to hear about your problems. I just wanted to talk about mine. Now, how selfish. But I just couldn't stand it. I was uncomfortable. I'd sit in the chair and I'd be like, God, I didn't want to talk to people. I didn't have anything in me to make me feel good about anything remotely social, like saying hello to people. I'm very fortunate. I got a good sponsor. And he found me. I didn't find him. He got my phone number. I didn't ask for his. I would never have given it to him. And I had been around AA. And so he asked me for my phone number. And I know how AA works. I'm a new guy. I know everything. And, with my couple of days of sobriety, I gave him my phone number. I knew he was not going to call me. The next day, this guy is on the phone. He's like, hey, do you want to go out for a cup of coffee? And I thought about it, and the answer to myself was no. I don't want to go out for coffee. I'm miserable, don't you know that? And he went out for coffee, and he began a long process with a bunch of other people of showing me how you live sober. And I needed it. I needed you to show me specifically, what do I do? I remember we went to the mall and drank coffee at this little espresso thing, and I thought, wow, I started looking around, I noticed the girls walking by, and I just thought, afterwards, not before or during even, but afterwards I thought, oh, that was cool. I want to go to the mall tomorrow, I want to drink coffee. And But I just hated the meetings. I was so uncomfortable, and some time went by, and I had so many tremendous problems. School was a big problem. It was not as hard anymore. I was an electrical engineering major, and when your first year is spent really stoned, that's like the foundation stuff. Your next year's pretty hard too. And I tell him about my problems. I'd just say, here, I had a mental list of what my problems were. If you asked me how it was going, you were usually sorry. I'd tell you, oh, well, I have a hard time talking to girls, and I don't have enough money because I didn't have a job, and, school was really hard because I wasn't studying, and, I don't like the meetings very much, and I just had all these little whiny problems, and I'd tell you all about them. And I want you to feel bad for me. And you get no sympathy in AA, except for maybe behind your back. Nobody was just telling me how, you have it so bad, As one woman told me, I was just, and I was mad, and I was angry. And this woman told me, she says, you're such an angry young man. And I've never wanted to kill anybody more in my life than that lady when she told me how angry I was. And she was right, but, you know, don't identify me, don't show me for what I am, don't make me look at myself. It was so uncomfortable. And through that process of people showing me, this is what you do when you're sober, and me telling my sponsor, here's my book of problems, because I have a lot, and I was expecting, he had like 8 or 9 years of sobriety at the time, and I was expecting really good answers to what was wrong. And he'd say, well, you know, you need to get to the meetings earlier and help set up. And I just thought, what an idiot. 9 years in AA, and he's got answers like, I need to get here earlier and set up. These are problems about money, power, and prestige, don't you understand? And he knew. He knew that I needed to become involved in my own sobriety. This program, and something he taught me, is about what I do. It is not about how I feel. Like the little boy who kicked a hole in the walls, great, you have the entire range of emotion. It's what I do with it. You know, my problem when I got here, I was not one of the people who says, well, you know, I need to get in. I thought maybe that's what I needed. Maybe I needed to get in touch with my feelings. And I was acutely in touch with my feelings. It's just that some of them weren't even valid. They weren't even appropriate to reality. They had no basis in what was happening in the real world. You know, I mean, I was quivering in fear at the possibility of going to one of these AA dances and asking a girl to dance with me. You know, the worst that could happen is that, you know, she would say no. But, I mean, I had the fear like she was going to pull out a machine gun and mow me down, you know. I mean, there's no reality there. It's just me and my feelings. And, oh, my feelings were just, oh, so special, let me tell you. My sobriety and my time in AA, whenever I got anything out of this program, it's always been about when I am doing something. This program and life in general is about what I do. It's just not about what I think and what I feel and what I want. You know, when I want something, then I got to do something. And that was explained to me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I told you, I used to sit on the bar with no plan. I just knew what I, you know, I had these grand dreams, but no idea. How do you get from here to here? It didn't even matter because in my mind, while I was drinking, there I was there. All right. It's never happened to me before. All right, I'm getting more. Shouldn't do that to me. It's anything that helps those brain cells flicker out is not good. Again, this program has been, and it was showed to me, somebody showed me that it's about what I do. If I have a goal instead of just a dream, a goal, and I want to achieve it, then I'm going to have to do something to get there. And the 12 steps gave me a good basic set of principles to live by so that I could set goals and achieve them. I could say, this is what I want to do, this is where I want to go. And some amazing things have happened to me in my sobriety. I know it's time to get sober and I should tell you all about it because you know all about how sick I am and that's just wonderful. I need to be actively involved in this program on a regular, consistent basis. And, you know, it's about my consistency more so than just, So I heard it explained this way once. When you're living in your car, you can't take 5 showers on one day and expect to smell good at the end of the week. And I'm no good doing 5 AA meetings in one day, and by the end of the week I'm not just as rosy as I was after those 5 meetings. truthfully, sometimes I don't even like to be in an AA meeting. I know I shouldn't say that from the podium, but sometimes I sit in the meeting and I think, God, I don't want to be here. Or I don't want to go to the meeting. But like it was with the drug and the alcohol, while I may not necessarily like the drink I'm drinking or the drug I'm taking, I was after the effect it was producing in my life. And while I may not like some of the people I meet or some of the meetings I go to in AA, it doesn't matter about that. I like the effect it is producing in my life. My life is a lot better than I thought it was ever going to be. Because after when I made that list of problems for my sponsor to tell him how unhappy I was, one of my big fears is that I was going to just have this boring, dull, glum life. I just didn't want that. I don't want that to be me. I want to be something else. And my life has been anything but boring. At this point, I am now sober almost as long as I drank and used alcoholically for. And today, sobriety is a bigger part of my story. What's happened to me in sobriety is a much bigger part of my story than what's happened to me while I was drinking. I finished school. Halfway through school, I had an opportunity to go to the People's Republic of China on an exchange program to help set up an exchange program. And there were no meetings. I had like a couple years of sobriety at this point. There's no meetings in China. At an international directory, it listed one meeting in Beijing, which was like more than 1,000 miles from where I was living. When I got there, they said, oh, that meeting's not here anymore. Those guys are gone. And before I left, I told my sponsor, I said, well, I'm really nervous because they don't have meetings in China. And he says, the 12 steps are principles that you apply in your life. And the principles are in this book. They're practiced to varying degrees in meetings. And if you apply these principles in your life, you will always get results. And before we went, he was beginning to be a pilot at that time. I had some aviation type of experience, and we got into a little airplane and flew out over the Canadian Rockies from Spokane, Washington to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan to go to a roundup. And we always called it getting closer to God. And because they were usually just harrowing flights. We got kind of caught in a snowstorm. It was pretty scary. I remember him telling me, it doesn't look good at one point. And I thought, you never want to hear that from the pilot. It doesn't look good. And he says, let's just do this. I'm supposed to be getting ready to go to China. I got so many things to do. I got to pack. I got to pack. It seemed like a lot. And when I got there, one of the speakers at this roundup was Curtis M. And at that point, he was in charge of Loners International out of GSO in New York. And Loners International, if you don't know, it's a meeting that comes to you on paper for people who are isolated around the world, whether it be somewhere remote in the United States or anywhere else. And he gave me his number and his address, and he says, write to me. He says, this is something you need to do. You need to write to me, and you will get this, and you will hear from other people in AA. And I did this, and I began to get letters from isolated alcoholics around the world. And it was an amazing thing. I liked reading the letters. Some people had their story on their computer, and they just hit print, and I'd get their whole frickin' story. And some of it was, like mine, is a lot to go through. I was like, oh, yeah. Drunk again, aren't you? Yeah. Okay. But it was my lifeline, and I read every one of those letters. And then I began to write them. And when I wrote those letters, it was in the taking of the action, in the doing of something, the taking part in my own sobriety, that I found more recovery. Reading it wasn't enough. Going to the meetings wasn't enough. I had to do something, do anything. And I felt better. No, I went for like 3 months without an AA meeting. I got sick. I got dysentery. I lost 22 pounds. I thought, God, I'm going to die. I got to get out of here. So I went to Hong Kong to go to a meeting. And I use this as my going to any length story, mostly for newcomers who like want to watch Wheel of Fortune and stuff like that. You want to go to a meeting? No. The wheel is on. And I'd say, you know, I wanted to go to a meeting, though. I really wanted, I needed, that's what I was doing. And from where I was in China to Hong Kong was hundreds, maybe 1,000, maybe more than 1,000 miles. It was far, too far to walk. I had to catch a little mini bus to take me to the train station, to go to Chengdu, to catch a train, to catch a plane, to take the hovercraft to Hong Kong to go to a meeting. And I went to a lot of meetings. I went to every meeting I could go to when I got there. And, they made a mistake. They let me talk, right? Because I had a lot to say after not being in a meeting for a few months. And they let me talk, and they waited until I was done, which was really impressive. And they must have good sponsors over there in Hong Kong. And then they did something that's really amazing. These people took me not just out for coffee, but they gave me this guided tour around Hong Kong. We went and they showed me all the sights. This is not something that happens to regular tourists when they go there. This was as a result of my involvement in this fellowship. And, I know there's people going to Hong Kong after hearing this now, going, where's the goddamn tour, you know? But it worked out that way. I got shown around and by people in this program, and it was a remarkable thing for me. And then I went back into China. I was there for 4 months until I was, well into self again. And I need to tell you that in the midst of that, though, I had my best day in China. And it started out as one of my worst. I knew I needed a meeting. It was not likely I was going to get to one real soon. And I went downtown in Chongqing. It's a Chinese city of about 13 million people. And I went downtown looking for tourists because I wanted to speak English to somebody and be understood. And I met up with this couple from Washington State. She had been in Al-Anon, so we talked a lot about that. And I said, well, let me show you around. And I took them places, and I did things, expecting nothing in return. And their visas were about to expire, and I took them to the security office, and I explained, and I cut through some red tape because I could understand what they were saying. And at the end of that day, after taking these people around on a little tour, I felt great about myself. I felt good about them. I felt good about myself. And this started off on a day where I was in the city of 13 million people, and I hated every one of them. And, again, it was taking action. And the action that I need to take rarely involves myself. If I do something, anything for somebody else, I don't know why, but it seems to produce an effect in my life that is far more than I ever expected. And it's really amazing that I should go from having my worst day to having my best day all at one shot. I got back, and there were some other Americans in the little compound we were in, and they were like, God, what did he get into out there? You know, I was positive, I was happy, in China, great. And for therapy there, I used to throw watermelons off the fourth floor to watch them explode. And I know it's not in the big book, but that too produced an effect in my life that was somewhat better than what I was having going on. That's an old brain cell that just flickered to life there. I don't know why you needed to know that, but I'm telling you anyways. I went to China. I did that. I stayed in school. I graduated. I went to work. I got a job as an insurance salesman, which I hated because people kept telling me no. They didn't always want what I had to sell, and I'm not good with that much rejection. I mean, this was like 40-50 phone calls a day of rejection, you know, and it wasn't always polite. And I decided that I wanted to be a pilot, and my sponsor was a pilot, and he seemed to like it, and I had been involved in aviation, and I really liked it. So I quit my job, and I sold virtually everything I had, which wasn't much, and I borrowed as much money as I could, and I decided I'm going to go be a pilot. And my parents thought I was kind of off on another one of my things, you know, sure, it was China, now it's a pilot, you know, great. And my girlfriend, I let her go, I released her, and she wanted to come with, too. I've always felt bad about that. I don't have time for that whole story, so I won't go into it. Anyways, I learned to fly airplanes, and after about a year, I had my commercial license and my instructor certificate, and I thought, I got to make a going thing of this, otherwise I'm just, you know, negative cash flow. And I got a job instructing, and I have been employed, and technically I still am up to this point. Most recently, for the last 2 years, I've been here in Bakersfield instructing Japanese airline pilots for a major Japanese airline. And that's a far cry from the guy who got out of the Navy and says, I can't stay in because I can't stay sober. I'm afraid we're going to just crash into a mountain or, you know, I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to do something wrong. And I really believe that if you get sober and you follow these principles and you apply them in your life, that great, great things will come to happen to you, for you, and about you. I can actually take pleasure in good things happening to other people. You know, before I was only interested in anything good happening to me. I care more about myself, I care more about you, I just care more about everything. Now that I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hate to come to the end of my talk and tell you, by the way, it's a spiritual program. And that you need... I'll try and sum this up. This is the best way I've ever heard it put. And that this is a spiritual program. And for a long time, I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't like what it meant, what I thought it meant. I didn't like talking about God. God, it made me feel uncomfortable, right? And I didn't like, you know, I just didn't. I didn't want to deal with God. I believed in God, and I had sort of lost any use for God. I always bargained. You know, this is what I need. This is what I'll do. And I didn't get anything. You know, I didn't get what I was bargaining for, so I thought, I have no use for God. And so I was kind of hung up on that whole issue when I got here, and I thought, you know, I need to be open-minded. I knew I needed to be open-minded about what spirituality was, and I was afraid it was chanting and holding hands and lighting candles and meditating and, you know, whatever else there is out there. And, you know, if that works for you, I got no problem with that. But for me today, the most spiritual thing I do, the most spiritual thing I do is when I connect with another alcoholic one-on-one. There's something very spiritual that happens to me on a different level that happens for me when I reach out actually to any other human being on a personal level. But more so, I don't know why, but more so when I reach out to another alcoholic and say, hi, what can I do to help? And if you're new and you're thinking, well, I don't know, you know, how much longer is he going to talk? Which is what I was thinking at one point. This is no problem. I'm not done either. There's something that happens there, and if you're new, I hope you'd find what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it requires you to reach out your hand. And that, for me, that was like one of the... If you'd have told me, and on paper, oh, well, to recover, you must reach out your hand, shake people's hands, say hi, and get involved. I could say, oh, yeah, that's real easy. But when I actually tried to do it, when I was in a meeting, I'd stick my hand out. I was so physically uncomfortable from my lack of desire to want to, you know, talk to somebody. I couldn't do it. Oh, God, what the hell am I going to say, you know? And it's that same age-old alcoholic conversation. Hi, my name's Patrick. Do you come to this meeting very often? Where else do you go to meetings? How long have you been sober? That's just a real brief encounter was enough to break the ice. And now that I've been sober, I don't know, over 9.5 years, I feel a responsibility because I know how hard that was for me to do. I know how much difficulty I had with that simple action of saying, hi, will you talk to me, please? I know today that it's my responsibility to reach out to somebody else. It produces a great effect in my life. If it helps them, it doesn't even matter if it works for that person. You know, newcomers come and go and come and go and come and go. It is in the taking of the action, of reaching out to someone else, that I feel the most spiritual. I have a lack of any better word for what happens when I do that, but it's spiritual. It touches me on a higher level. And, you know, I do. I make an effort to reach out to people and say, even if it's just that basic conversation, I know what you have been through. I can associate this with you. And that's like an hour. It's got to be. I'm pretty much done here. And I can just tell you that the promises in the big book are true, and they are coming true in my life, and they will come true in your life. Just do something. I don't know how I can't put it any better than that. You got to do something. You got to take part in your own sobriety. You know, I mean, people can throw big books at you all day long, but you have to make the effort. This is a program for people who want to be here. If it was a program for people who needed to be here, not particularly this meeting, but the rooms would all be full. We'd be looking for extra places to hold meetings. There's lots of people who need to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seems to me that the people who are the ones who stay are the people that make the effort, they get involved, and they reach out to other people. Thanks for letting me talk.